Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. The speech you're about to listen to was originally recorded at DEF CON 5 at the Aladdin Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1997. Now all rights are reserved except permission for educational non-profit use. If you have any questions about DEF CON or the copyright status, contact me at dtangent@defcon.org or the website at www.defcon.org. Now kick back and relax.
I can see everybody leaving. Let me tell you that Tom Farley was supposed to be up here with me, who is the editor of Private Line, but he was unable to make it. What I'm going to present is a little history of Alexander Graham Bell, a history of the legal cases that AT&T uses when they say you have to pay your telephone bill. And then thirdly, I'm going to cover how you hack a PBX and how you secure a PBX, utilizing examples from the history that the company that I work for has identified over the years through actual hacking attacks. I'll give you a little bit of background of myself. 5 years ago, my only contact with telecommunications was my grandfather was a janitor for Pacific Bell in the state of Oregon. He started out probably in the 20s and eventually retired from there. Rather odd at that time for an Oriental to be working for a company such as Pacific Bell in any capacity. My aunt spent about 30 years of her life as an operator. Now we all remember the lady operators, don't we? Do you know why they were lady operators? No. No, in the late 1800s, they used to have boys, young men, on roller skates, making connectivities from point A to point B in the telephone company. But these young men also abused their privilege and did a certain amount of social engineering and harassment. And so what they did was they terminated them, hired women, and that's why you had ladies as operators for as many years as they did. Well, 5 years ago, I became acquainted with the company Teledesign Management, started working in the area of PBX toll fraud. One of the products that we developed was PBX security audit. And in the hundreds that we have done, we have identified certain trends of how you hack a PBX and how you secure PBX. But in keeping with the private line philosophy and the information I believe that I have gathered both from the 2600 community in San Francisco and from attending the DEF CON conference here and Hope and other places, I'd like to give you a little history of Alexander Graham Bell, who was born in 1847, March 3rd, in Edinburgh, Scotland, and he died August 2nd, 1922, in his Nova Scotia home. He was named after his grandfather, who was an actor and an individual interested in good speech. Graham, his middle name, was adopted from a family friend and was used by close friends and family. His father, Alexander Melville Bell, wrote textbooks on correct speech. He taught deaf mutes to speak and invented visible speech, a code using the position of the throat, the tongue, and the lips to produce sound, to guide the deaf in learning to speak. His mother, Elsie Grace Simmons, was a painter and musician. Now, Bell had a talent for music. He played by ear as a young child and received a music education. At the age of 15, he and his brother assisted their father in demonstrating the visible speech technique. And he traded the teaching of music and speech in exchange for instruction at a private boys' school. Bell went on to the university, shortly becoming a full-time teacher, as well as continuing the visible speech classes. While still a teenager, he continued to experiment with electricity and tuning forks to determine how vowel sounds were produced, a teenager. This creativity and practicality to use and understand the principles from a variety of different academic traditions was to stay with him all his life. In his 20s, he specialized in the anatomy of vocal apparatus at University College in London, and he took charge of his father's work in visible speech promotion. His two brothers passed away of tuberculosis, and so they moved to Nova Scotia, or to Ontario, Canada, and Graham soon regained his health. Now, there were two men, the father of his wife-to-be, Gardner Green Hubbard, and a Thomas Sanders, a Boston merchant, both who came in contact with Bell through his work with visible speech and the deaf. They heard about his electrical experiments conducted at night and offered to pay the cost. So, you know, your work and effort can pay off if you find a sponsor. It was outside of his regular work and activity teaching the deaf that on March 10, 1876, Thomas A. Watson, a friend, heard the famous words, "Mr. Watson, come here, I want you." Intelligible speech transmission by wire to another location was born. Bell had many other interests, and he eventually was awarded by the French government a Volta Prize of 50,000 francs in 1880 for his invention of the telephone. He used the money to assist the establishment of the Volta Laboratory, and the funds that received continued to develop the work with the deaf. But one of the things in my research that I found was that Bell had a national network vision for telecommunications. And the first telephone company was actually the Bell Patent Association. And while Bell was over in France, he came up with this quote, which I quote from A History of the Engineering and Science in the Bell System, the early years. This is what he said about the national network. "The telephone may be briefly described as an electrical contrivance for reproducing in distant places the tones and articulations of a speaker's voice, so that conversation can be carried on by the word of mouth between persons in different rooms, in different streets, or in different towns. The great advantage it possesses over every other form of electrical apparatus consists in the fact that it requires no skill to operate the instrument. All of the telegraph machines produce signals which require to be translated by experts, and such instruments are therefore extremely limited in their application. But the telephone actually speaks, and for this reason it can be utilized for nearly every purpose for which speech is employed. At the present time, we have a perfect network of gas pipes, water pipes throughout our large cities. We have main pipes laid under the streets communicating with side pipes, with the various dwellings. There are some people that want to listen.
Have some respect, come on, guys.
Anyway, the infrastructure was to enable the members to draw their supplies of gas and water from a common source. In a similar manner, he envisioned it was conceivable that cables of telephone wires could be laid underground or suspended overhead, communicating with branch wires with private dwellings, country houses, shops, manufactories, etc., etc., uniting them through the main cable with a central office where the wires could be connected as desired, establishing direct communication between two places in the city. Such a plan as this is impractical at the present moment, Wilhelm, we firmly believe, to be the outcome of the introduction of the telephone to the public. Not only so, but I believe in the future wires will unite the head offices of the telephone company in different cities, and a man in one part of the country may communicate by word of mouth with another in a distant place. I'm aware that such ideas may appear to you utopian and out of place, for we are met together for the purpose of discussing not the future of the telephone, but the present. Believing, however, as I do, that such a scheme will be the ultimate result of introducing the telephone to the public, I will impress upon you all the advisability of keeping this and in view that all present arrangements of the telephone may be eventually realized in this grand system. In conclusion, I would say that it seems to me that the telephone should immediately be brought prominently before the public as a means of communication between bankers, merchants, manufacturers, wholesale and retail dealers, dock companies, water companies, police offices, fire stations, newspaper offices, hospitals, and public buildings, and for use in railway offices, in mines, and diving operations. Agreements should also be speedily concluded for the use of the telephone in the Army and Navy and by the Postal Telegraph Department. Although there is a great field for the telephone in the immediate present, I believe there is still greater in the future. By bearing in mind the great object to be immediately achieved, I believe that the telephone company can not only secure for itself a business of the most remunerative kind, but also benefit the public in a way that has never previously been attempted. That was Bell's vision. Now, if you were to substitute the word computer for telephone, don't you basically have the same vision? But not only is it just national, it is international in scope. But I hope you caught it back there in that his letter that it said anybody can use the telephone. How many of you have heard the story of 2 and 3 year olds dialing 911 because a member of the family has had an emergency in the home? Yeah, we've all heard very simple to operate. There was the Bell Patent Association was the first telephone company. The Bell Telephone Company, New England Telephone Company, Bell Telephone Company, the National Bell Telephone Company, the American Bell Telephone Company, American Telephone and Telegraph Company. Now, these were all companies that led up through the years from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. And of course, we know that for approximately the next 50 years, while we had the big AT&T system, until divestiture in 1984. With divestiture, we know that the big AT&T system was broken up, and we find that it was split up into long distance and network, and of course other small companies, and eventually even broke up more recently and renamed the equipment division becoming Lucent Technology. But one of the things that is also happening is we're seeing a effort to re-merge the telecommunications system into bigger and bigger units, and the problem is that some of them will succeed, such as Southwestern Bell and Pacific Bell, but others will fail, such as AT&T and Southwestern Bell. But besides these Bell, former Bell and Bell operating companies, you have all these, quote, interconnects, GT&E being one of those. But there's what? Rochester Telephone Company, Bell South, which is an Arbok. But you have close to 100 or more independent telco companies throughout the United States. Besides that, you have private companies, such as those that I work for. You also have equipment companies. There are approximately 43 toll fraud protection manufacturers. There are approximately 35 customer premise equipment representatives and manufacturers. There are approximately 42 key system manufacturers. And in voice messaging, 51 companies represented. Premise distribution equipment, 22. Wiring and cable manufacturers, approximately 43. And a host of other related companies that deal with telecommunications. Now, because of the hacker problems that have arisen, and yes, it probably really came to prominence in the late 1980s, the problem is that hacking and the problems go back in history. And has been pointed out in other presentations, case law has not really been definitively established in the computer prosecution area. What is a computer crime? They don't know yet. You cannot go through a series of case law and say, this is how it has been determined. But one thing that has been determined is that, number one, the FCC and the courts have said whoever it is that basically owns the telephone system is responsible to pay for the phone calls made through that system. At the in-bank hearings that the FCC held, Many of the equipment vendors said, customer beware, in their presentation. Many of the customers wanted, help share the liability, help us secure our system. But when it finally boiled down to it, the FCC really does not have any control over security. What AT&T has used are cases going back to 1915. The 1915 case was Southwestern Tel versus Sharp White. The telephone company had set up rules requiring that the phone subscriber pay for all calls originating at their office. The subscriber refused to pay for calls not okayed by them. It was held for Southwestern Bell. The phone company was permitted to charge the subscriber for calls originating on the line. The next case goes back to 1930. Crawford County versus Bushmeyer Sheriff. Here are the facts. The county court rented space and subscribed to phone service. The space was subsequently occupied by the sheriff. When the phone bill was supplied or delivered to the sheriff's office, he refused payment and referred the bill to the county court. There were unauthorized phone calls made by people through the sheriff's telephone. It was held that it was a reasonable rule that a telephone company to require that the telephone where long-distance calls originate shall be responsible for payment of the charges, therefore. The reason is that the subscriber can easily control the use of his telephone by third persons, while it is impossible for the telephone operators to know and recognize the voices of all persons using a telephone for long-distance purposes and to know to whom these calls should be charged in the absence of such regulation. Jeff Gaither versus Mountain State Telephone Company. A house guest made third-party calls, charged them to Jeff's phone. Jeff complained he didn't want to have to pay for those phone calls. It was held for Mountain State Telephone. There was a case in 1989 between AT&T and ITT Financial Corp. The interesting thing is that I called ITT because I could not find the legal documentation on the case and how it was concluded. And they said, well, what happened was it was remanded back to the attorneys, and there was a settlement. And I said, what was the settlement of the case? Oh, we can't disclose the information. And I asked, fine. Apparently then you didn't pay. And he said, we didn't. And what actually happened in that particular case, the customer found that the service provider had set up the switch in such a way that it allowed fraud to occur, and the maintenance vending company assumed the liability and paid the bill. Eldred Corporation, 1990. Said that in this case it was versus MCI, that a PBX was purchased, compromised for $16,000, and sued both the equipment manufacturer and MCI, and they said that the installation was negligent, and there was failure to warn. But, and that MCI was negligent and failure to warn, and it was held for MCI, and the case against the equipment manufacturer was removed from state court. Pacific Mutual and AT&T, $128,000 worth of fraud through the heating and air conditioning control. system attached to the PBX. And it was a default function, and of course it was held for AT&T. Now DISA, back in the 1980s, was a God's gift to customer mankind by the telco company. It allowed you to call into the switch and get outbound dial tone. Great! I can call from any place in the United States, dial into the switch, and the company pays my salesman phone bill. Not only the salesman, but anybody else who found that number and the feature that was available. Today, in the telecommunications industry, if you want DISA activated, you generally have to sign a statement saying that you have asked for that feature in order for them to put it in the switch. There was a case against Jiffy Lube. Jiffy Lube used some of the same arguments, failure to warn, no control mechanisms put in, and they were required to pay by the court. Now there are other cases. One of them is in the state of New York. There was a human resource department of the city. In that particular case, there were some employees who utilized the feature capabilities of the PBX, and they set up a telephone system. And even though it was employees, resource department had to pay the bill, but I'm sure the people that set it up were no longer employed with the state of New York. In another situation, it happened to be a customer-owned telephone company. They asked the RBOC to secure their system to prevent international calls, to not allow paper call numbers through the switch. Every possible item of security that they could think of, they requested of the company establishing their capability. They were hit with fraud. Hackers were able to get secondary dial tone. But when they went for a court and FCC ruling, they ruled that in this case, this COCOT had performed their due diligence for security, and they did not have to pay their liability for a tariff responsibility. Now, one of the items that has been mentioned throughout all the presentations here has been hackers, system administrators, people who are responsible for computer networks, and some of you are also responsible for telecommunications networks. The problems that you have to deal with is that, well, I'm interested in computers. I don't care about the telecommunications system. The only problem is that if you reach a level of responsibility in your company or in your consulting contract, you may have to deal with the telecommunications aspect of the data network. Because I can shut you off completely from your computer network by not giving you any connectivity, period, to any kind of telecommunication system. All you would be able to do is everything internally, and there you're dealing with tele-abuse or basically on customer premise titles abuse of your computer network. All you have to do is send all your mail out using the United States Government Postal Service, and basically you have no connectivity with anybody else, which is highly impractical. So one of the things that was developed was the security audit of the PBX. Now you have to understand that the PBX is a computer system, but it is also designed slightly different. Can anybody tell me the difference between a PBX computer system and a system computer system such as your PC? No, sorry. What about the software? Yeah, but it's an operating system. What? No? 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 Okay. You have to understand that theoretically now, you never get to source code in a PBX. All you are really doing are manipulating and changing feature capabilities in the PBX computer system. On the other side, you can actually get down to, as everybody has said here, clear to source code. Now, yeah, there are some engineering back passwords and on some of the systems and so on and so forth, but in, I would say, 99% of the time, you will never get to source code of a PBX. So if you take that and you move along on the two sides here, what you have to do is you have to understand what and how to deal with each of the systems. Take two different people, a hacker and a system administrator. Essentially, you should have to have the same skills. Number one, you should know your switch inside and out. You should read the manual. Now, one of the first bulletins that I ran across was Scott Simpson's report on hacking the System 75, which is an AT&T system. How many of you have read that document? Okay, I've only seen one hand out here. What's the matter with the rest of you? Now, Scott Simpson's report said in it that his wife was a system administrator and he had access to all the books. And that's how he knew how he could actually compromise the System 75. Well, if you're a system administrator, you better know and understand that the same books, in order to administer that switch and to be able to secure it. The other day, we had performed a security audit on a switch in the Midwest. And I basically had told the system administrator that their switching capability from voicemail through the PBX was secure. They had all the denials in the phone mail that did not allow transfer to dial tone out of phone mail. So, like a good system administrator, she went back to corporate headquarters back in the East, and she said, I don't believe it. She called back. She called her mailbox. She hit a couple of codes. Bingo! Outside dial tone. Well, she was sitting back and gloating. She called up her maintenance provider and kind of confided in them that You know, this audit report was not all that good because they said that I couldn't get out of my phone mail mailbox and get outside dial tone, but I did it. Fine. We did a system readout of the audit report, and I said, you're the system administrator, aren't you? She said, yes. What classes of service have you given yourself? The highest. Do you have trunk-to-trunk capability? Yes. Well, you've just given yourself permission to dial out of the system. It was really an unfair test. Now, one of the other questions in the audit report says, hey, if you're going to give yourself that feature capability, if you don't need it to actually do anything on a real-time basis, every day, every hour of the day, take it out and only put it in when you need it. She had not thought to remove that capability from her own phone when she didn't need it. Now, it's the thought processing of a person. Here we have a system administrator, and we have somebody that wants to compromise the system. They could have found out who the system administrator was, social engineered their way into that her mailbox, and then tried the feature transfer codes and gotten out of the system. Oh boy. Working with your vendor. Now, as a hacker, some people have tried to call in. I was sitting in the office of a facilities manager, and she was on the phone with this AT&T technician. And the AT&T technician said, I need to get into your switch so that I can take care of some network problems. I have been authorized to perform work in your switch. And she said, who authorized it? The person on the phone could not give an answer. I have this work order in front of me, was the reply. And the person was good on the other end of the phone. I must say that because he kept asking different questions to try and get this facility manager to grant permission to access the PBX. And she finally came out and said, you know, I'm the only one that can authorize that, and I never authorized that. And besides that, the person whose company we use to access the switch for those kinds of activities is sitting right in my office at this time, and I haven't issued him any orders. So she knew, and she applied the good security techniques in a case of social engineering. I talked with one of the members of the Legion of Doom a couple of years ago, and he told me that approximately 90% of his success was social engineering. It was a failure of the human element in the telephone system, shall we say, architecture that allowed a hack to be perpetrated. So test out your social engineering skills. The only problem with that is that more and more people are becoming aware, and it's becoming slightly more difficult, but at the same time, there's too many people out there that haven't gotten the message, even though they have been told time and time and time again. We had a case from the European continent, fiber optic from Europe to New York, fiber optic from New York to San Francisco. Copper cable connectivity to an AT&T PBX. A loop out of the system back to Germany. And a German joke line recorded on a repetitive basis. This particular joke line was generating about $2,000 of fraud calls every night. Now, not necessarily all through this particular switch. The system administrator was a vice president with other responsibilities, and she was driving home and using her cell phone. It was about 4:30 on a Friday afternoon, and she called my boss and was talking about it. Said, "Oh, well, our vendor has told us we're secure. I'm not going to do anything over the weekend." And my boss started reiterating some of these horror stories of what happened and said, "We know what the problem is already. You have a maintenance port that has been hacked, and you have a weekend coming up, and they'll get back into your system." "We don't have a maintenance port. We didn't ask that one be set up. No, our vendor comes in on premise to service the equipment." It was a System 75. And what we did was, in the half-hour conversation between the time she first got on the cell phone to the time she almost returned home, we had scared her enough that she said, "I will be in my office at 8 o'clock in the morning and allow your technician to come and inspect our PBX." We got there. Sure enough, they didn't have the maintenance port connected the normal way. The switch was a gray area moved by their particular vendor, and a separate DID number had been routed around to the maintenance port function, and it actually came through the switch, and somebody had found it, changed some parameters, and allowed outdialing through the switch. Needless to say that, fortunately, in the contract, they were told not to establish the maintenance port of the PBX. It would be on-premise maintenance, we never did hear what the final settlement was on who paid the final bill, but I'm sure it wasn't the company that owned the switch. Mitsubishi headquarters, New York City, Aditya application. Here again, you have the problem of people. Mitsubishi, a Japanese-owned company. The Japanese have a different type of culture in terms of management and management style. And one of the things is that, quote, "the men are a little bit more authority figures than women and those who are under them." And as a managing person who comes from the old country, I want certain features on my telephone. And in this particular case, it happened to be the DISA function. The DISA function was identified as the vulnerability that was exploited, I think to the tune of about $1.4 million. There was a settlement, and I think they only paid about $400,000. But they did switch from the carrier that they did have to another carrier because of the problems that they had. The reason we know this is because we performed an audit on both of the switches. We identified DISA as the vulnerability and other vulnerabilities and told them to correct the system vulnerability. Over a year later, I asked the network carrier that was now handling the account if they had done away with the DISA feature. And they had. And the way they had done it is they had protected it. But they had done so in such a way that it was still usable. They took the measures to secure themselves as much as they possibly could. Again, people and the way you set up the switch, that's how it gets hacked. And anybody can connect with the switch if you have the telephone number. And how do you have that telephone number? You have that telephone number by just dialing 7 digits. So from that standpoint, your major problem is going to be outside people who can exploit the way inside people have set up the system, and inside people can secure the system if they have the support of not only the technical people, but the people of upper management. I'll be available for the rest of the conference. Feel free to come by and ask me any questions that you would like. I'll be happy to answer them within the proprietaries of our security management. But one of the things I do want to express is I appreciate DT, what he is trying to do here at the conference, and bringing together this forum so that you can find out what it is you need to know about computer systems, what it is you need to know about telecommunication systems, so that out there in the real world, we can have a functioning telecommunications and computer network. Thank you very much.